Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Matt Hillary, CTO of Access Corp. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming down and meeting us in person and telling us a bit about your story. So unlike me being locked in the basement with a Commodore VIC-20, you were doing like normal stuff during your adolescent years. What was that all about?
I was not expecting to end up in tech, I guess, if you asked me in college. I've always been a techie, but I've never thought of myself as a software guy. That's right.
So then you graduate, and how do you start your career?
Well, I started my career in the restaurant business, actually, and I got bounced out of the restaurant business, which is a long story. That's probably a whole podcast in and of itself, which is probably going to be more interesting than my life story, but we'll have to come back to that one. My father was an entrepreneur and had a business, a manufacturing business. And in college, I had actually worked in the business one summer and I knew a little bit about what was going on. It was in the midst of a real growth spurt. And when I bounced out of the restaurant business, he compelled me to come in full time. And I kind of became an understudy of one of the engineers in the business. And at the time, because I'm so old and it was so long ago, you know, there was this kind of random association between computers and young people. And so it was just assumed that I would pick it up more quickly. So I became the understudy of the computer control system on this equipment manufacturing business. And I took to it, I enjoyed it. And after, I don't know, a couple of years, I guess I moved on, but I moved into another controls job in software. And the rest is history.
Now, when you were at that company, the VP of engineering was kind of like the mad scientist type, and you had to translate him into reality?
Yeah, so he was an MIT guy. I think his nickname with all the guys in the field was the professor, and they all just reviled this guy because, like, oh, don't give him a screwdriver. He's dangerous. You know, he's kind of the classic professor, very smart, but not very practical, and I was the person that helped him bridge the gap between the engineering drawing board and the field where the real work was getting done.
That could be an entire career.
Yep. That's right.
So you move on and you move, now that you've gotten your feet wet with controls, you go to another controls type company?
Yeah, I stayed in industrial automation and I worked for a company at the time that was called Andover Controls in Andover, Massachusetts, and had a great run with them. I really learned the software business. It was a direct digital control microprocessor based system. And I learned the industry, I learned the technology, and I ended up ultimately, I did some product marketing there and some product management there, but I ended up on the software team. I just had a great run. It was a great company to work for.
You get to travel quite a bit with them.
Travel right? Quite a bit. Their core business was in building automation, and all of the new high rises that were being built weren't happening in the United States. They had all been built. All the high rises were being built in Asia. So there was a lot of work in Asia.
You spent some time in South Korea, right?
I spent over a year in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I kind of moved out of that business was because I was burnt out and I had a life in South Korea and I had a life in Asia and I had a life here, I felt like. And, you know, I was looking for different opportunities. But to this day, I'll be honest, I somewhat regret it because there was a big opportunity to work in Kuala Lumpur and I was burnt out. And I don't know. I learned so much with that company and there was so much growth. But yeah, I moved on from controls after a number of years and stayed in software, but moved to financial services in Boston.
Ah, FinServ in Boston. That's a little different
than the mutual fund industry. Yeah, I was surprised. You'd think it would be more complicated. But for me, coming from industrial automation, the front office is a lot softer. You know, when things go down in industry, there's real consequences on the line. There's human safety on the line. There's usually very, very expensive production lines that are on the line. You know, there's all kinds of consequences that are very tangible and very high stakes.
The FinServ guys like to tell you, if something's off by a penny, some heads are going to roll.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a little bit more removed. And, you know, I'm sure it's high pressure in the right role. But where I started in FinServ, you know, I was down in the bowels of the IT organization and so forth.
What were you doing down there?
Well, I found the recurring theme for me has always been content. And I, even in the mutual fund business, there was a lot of automation going on around document production. So I was doing a lot of dynamic document publishing. So, you know, this is early content management days. And companies were trying to figure out how to get all the compliance language assembled into a document and all of the performance language assembled into a document. So these snippets of data and content were coming from different departments inside the organization. And they wanted to build something that was very efficient to assemble these documents on the fly, quarter after quarter and so forth. So I spend a lot of time building platforms to manage dynamic content publishing.
And then how'd you get involved with SolidSense?
So SolidSense was a startup, and it was really founded around that idea of content publishing. SolidSense, actually, there were two versions of the company, but the first version of the company was a dynamic document publishing platform tailored to the research industry. So boutique research shops would buy this platform early days, really before there was standardized web content management and ECM technology, and run their business on that platform. And then later, we partnered with one of the emerging leaders in the WCM space, a company called Ektron out of Southern Massachusetts. We became Ektron's largest partner. We built a lot of add-on components all around content management.
You told me some stories about your VP of engineering, who was a bit of a legend there.
Yes, Bundit. Yep, Bundit was quite a legend. He was Thai. For a while, we had a big Thai engineering department. Every day, someone was responsible for making lunch.
Oh, that must have been awesome.
It was really good. It was a good time. I learned a lot from Bundit. Bundit's saying was always manage the process. And we focused a lot on repeatability and outcomes that were driven by process rather than focusing on one particular problem. And I think, you know, that learning really served me well over the long haul. It was interesting. It came from this guy who was a very soft walking leader. He would get a lot of people excited about the process, and the outcomes that we were able to produce were quite remarkable.
Didn't he make everyone come over for classes on Saturdays?
Yeah, that was a big thing for him. Yep. There was optional, although I think everybody on the team went, Saturday technology classes in the basement, in his basement. Part of his philosophy that was so effective was he was very good about bringing the bottom up. He brought in a lot of junior people on work visas, no surprise, from Thailand. But there was a lot of focus on training the youngest and the newest staff and continuing to bring up a bench of solid players. He always had junior people presenting in the presentations, you know, in an engineering meeting or a presentation to management or even to a customer. It was always more junior people than you might expect. And as a result, there's this kind of rising tide effect in the organization. I've worked for other people over the years that have done that as well. I never worked at TI, but I've known engineers that have worked at Texas Instruments, and I think they had a similar kind of philosophy where the junior people did the presentations and there was a lot of focus on bringing the bottom up.
Now, how did focusing on the process and managing the process lead to better throughput and quality in your estimation?
Well, I think, you know, there's always going to be problems in a technical business, right? I mean, that's what we do every day. And I think you can focus a lot of energy on solving those problems. But once you have the breakthroughs that are bound to happen, the question is, what are you going to do next time differently, you know, to make how you attack those problems more efficient? So rather than focusing all of your energy around a specific problem, you know, kind of purpose-driven process around how you deal with these kinds of technical challenges makes it more repeatable. It's subtle, but it creates a big difference in the end in terms of how the team can be more efficient at throughput.
Well, it sounds a bit like total quality management. And I imagine that even those junior developers were empowered to make suggestions about improving the process.
I think that's right. It's very similar in a very technical space. That's right.
So did that company end up getting acquired?
We ended up selling. We sold to a relatively local shop called Verndale. And I think that a good portion of the team stayed on with Verndale after my departure. And, you know, it was a good strategic acquisition.
So what did you end up doing after that?
After that, I felt that there's really been, I think I've lost track. We've got to be in like the ninth life of content management. There's been these wave after wave of innovation and different groups of companies involved in the industry. And I think at the time I felt that I knew a thing or two about the content management business. So I went and joined an M&A shop that was going to let me set up a practice area just kind of focused on that industry. I know a lot of the folks, and there's just a lot of consolidation going on.
So did that end up panning out?
It did for a while, but it was a small boutique shop. And unfortunately, the firm that I was working for, the founders of the firm were working on this mega deal that was in the shoe industry or the athletic shoe industry. And they had an opportunity to jump into this project that they were working on. And kind of overnight, I had to decide whether I was going to join them in the athletic shoe industry or continue my journey in content management. And it just didn't make any sense to me. So I had to say, no, thanks, guys. I'll pass.
What were they doing in the shoe industry?
They were working with a founder that had developed a better soccer boot. And, you know, there's a little bit of technology, and through the use of technology and design, you could kick the soccer ball harder and faster and so forth.
Huh.
And they got one of the major players to acquire it. So it was an incredible outcome, but I unfortunately missed the boat on it.
Yeah, you know what? Tom Brady came in, lost the Super Bowl more times than a lot of people ever.
Well, that's probably true. I believe in a certain amount of karma. What value was I going to add, you know? I could build the website for the shoe company, I suppose, but that's about it.
So you stick with content management. What happens next?
Next, I went back to a vendor in the space, a manufacturer, an OEM, and I guess there was a quick turnaround. I got another company sold in the ECM space. And then I went out after that to do a startup with a couple of founders. That startup was called CareSpace, ultimately was the name. And unfortunately, we did. That was my one startup in my past that didn't make it.
That was around the time of the financial crisis, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like 08, 09?
Yeah, we were just a little bit slow on execution and a little bit late to the party, and we just couldn't get the funding that we had raised some angel money, and it was looking pretty good, but just the timing didn't work out. I think a couple of our competitors made it out, but we did not.
But you met some folks there, specifically some developers from overseas that you ended up working with again and again, right?
Yep, that's right. I built a team offshore for that startup in Belarus, and that team has grown over the years, and they've been with me on a number of projects. They're not with me right now, but Alex and Sergey, if you're listening, I'm sure we'll be back together someday soon.
We're putting the band back together.
Oh, yeah. That seems to be a recurring theme.
So the next company where you did work with those guys was Fontys, right?
Yep. Fontys was another content play in the governance, risk, and compliance space, but really around content. And we built a content publishing platform, no surprise, that acquired legal information from around the world and sold it into financial services, essentially. So we did that. It was a good project. It was a native cloud ground up build in the content space. And it was technology that I'm proud of and solved a very niche-y little business problem, but ultimately sold that.
I was going to say, when you do that, usually one of your customers says, hey, I really need this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Who'd you end up selling it to?
Well, we sold to a strategic. We didn't sell to a customer, but we had, it was a funny thing. When we sold, we had very few customers, in fact, but they were all very, very large financials. And so the thing that we were doing was solving a problem in the records management industry. And Iron Mountain, local Boston company, is kind of the largest player in the records management space. So ultimately, they agreed to acquire us. We had decided that there was enough volatility in what we were doing that we didn't want to take another bite at the apple. And there was quite a bit of interest in the firm from Iron Mountain and from others. So we decided to get out.
So you become part of Iron Mountain. Are you running that same sort of record management business for them?
Yep. I help them expand that software across the company and grow the practice. It was an interesting journey. Iron Mountain's a great company. It's a little known business to many, I think, but the box business, which is their core business, is box storage, is a highly profitable endeavor. And the problem with the business is that the thing that they store in the boxes is paper. And as one would expect, generally speaking, the paper is going away. So there's all these initiatives at companies like Iron Mountain in the box business to figure out how to be more digital. And so the thing that I had built was a piece of the future strategy for Iron Mountain.
Digital records management can be just as unwieldy as paper if you don't organize it well.
That's right. And that was really the key to that solution, was that it was kind of media agnostic. It didn't matter. The solution wasn't about the media type, whether it was paper or magnetic tape or spinning disc or paper. It's all records, and you typically have to manage them according to the same set of regs.
So like knowing how long to keep something, when to throw it out, legal holds, all that stuff?
Exactly right. Yeah, okay. Exactly right. Yeah.
And then after Iron Mountain, you're now at Access?
I'm at Access, yeah.
And what are you up to there?
Well, it's interesting. So similar industry, but a little bit different approach. So it definitely sponsors at Access connected with me or talking about the opportunity. And I was talking to these guys about various things. And they said, well, we want to talk about something, you know, that we think you might be helpful with in storage. And, you know, I'm a Boston software guy. And when you say storage, I think you're talking about ECM or Net Appliance or whatever. And they're like, no, not that storage. And then it's, oh, that storage. We can talk about that if you'd like. So we talked over a long period of time and the opportunity kind of unfolded. And what's interesting about it is this is really an interesting opportunity to do something very different. This is a full-on digital transformation of a mid-sized company. So the subject matter still happens to be records management, in fact, but it's about how you take a mid-market company and that's very, very traditional and make it very, very digital. So it's the combination of software and subject matter and business model all rolled together. So super interesting project.
So you're trying to take the metadata or the data about the data and glean insights from it? Or what are you doing to kind of modernize this?
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, we think that companies are all on their own digital transformation journey. A lot of businesses have a fair amount of legacy paper process, and they're trying to figure out what to do about that and how to accelerate, you know, certainly post-pandemic now, they're trying to figure out how to, you know, move quicker in that direction. And so we're trying to build service offerings that are digitally enabled that really help our customers make that transformation all that much more quickly. So I think what that means is it's everything about how you engage with the customer. It's not just, you know, we've got a large tool set that can help you digitize paper and a technology stack that can help you make the information more valuable, to your point. But it's also how you engage with the customer. It's the business model. It's important to try and position this in a way that customers are used to consuming services today. It's a subscription. It's not a big, huge technology sell where you've got to install a bunch of gear and you got to train the gear and you got to train the people and all of this stuff. It's got to be a lot more nimble and lightweight.
What sort of technology stack are you guys working with?
It's a cloud native stack, all the latest and greatest tools. I think one of the interesting components, there's a couple really interesting elements to the technology. One of the interesting elements is security, actually. You know, we're an information management company. And we're trying to bake in security controls that meet the highest, most rigorous standards in the industry. But we're trying to do it in a really, really modern way so that the security doesn't slow us down from being that innovative partner that we think our customers want. That's kind of cutting edge. You're looking for the latest, most nimble tools that can plug into your CI/CD pipelines. You're looking for partners that have the hottest, smartest security sensing tools on the market. It's all pretty cutting edge stuff. But, you know, at the end, I think that the security becomes a real strategic component or advantage to what we're doing.
And nobody has a sense of humor about having their data found by anyone else. So that's got to be job one with managing their information for them. But you still got to be able to move. You can't paralyze yourself with security measures. So it's a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, I think it's a real differentiator between some guys in a garage that have got really hot technology and an enterprise that's got day in and day out security threats that they have to deal with and just the grind of that. So if you can be a vendor that services that enterprise grade security requirement and still be innovative, there's just a lot fewer of those folks around.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Cerence? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
We talked a bit in the pre-call about being able to plug all these services into a pipeline where you can then cherry pick your data from, but you really need what you call the data steward to help people navigate that.
Yeah, that's another key element to the transformation that we're going through on top of security integration. We're trying to integrate the data in the business, particularly the operational data in our enterprise, using really modern tools. And so we have this vision for a really integrated, high-performance data mesh. But in the short term, how we envision getting there is just better, or maybe different is the right word for it, custodians of the data in the enterprise. So rather than a team that is responsible for ETL activity, loading data into a data warehouse and figuring out on every single project what data is required and what it needs to look like and how it needs to be shaped and transformed and all of this stuff, what we're trying to do is set up data custodians that are the rightful owners of the source data. And we want those people to think more like a product manager than a system administrator, so that when the business comes looking for data, they're able to answer in a more helpful way. Well, this is how I understand your request, and this is how I would present that data. And that packaging of the data, we think, will save us a lot of time importing operational data around the place. There's a lot of data warehouse. We're an ops company. And so there's a lot of bits and bytes that get shared in the name of process improvement and efficiency. It could be a lot more efficient to get at that data. And we think that part of that comes from better stewardship.
Now, with these data stewards being, as you said, kind of product managers, does the data become a product?
You know, I think so. We have like short-term goals. We actually have to produce near-in products, but I think that could be the killer app in all of this. And I don't really have an answer yet, but that's how I defend the investment. I say, look, you know, there's a lot of short-term gains in this strategy, but if you squint your eyes and think about the long term and the kind of information that we handle and what our customers are asking of us and so forth, I think that alternate data monetization strategies are definitely interesting.
So doing this in an established company, it's got to be different than like if you were just some startup doing this from scratch, you could pick whatever you wanted. How does that work within an operating enterprise?
Yeah, I think that's right. If you're doing this from scratch with a really good team, you probably wouldn't even think about the problems that you have to think about inside the existing enterprise. You would just go out and pick the best tool set and move as quickly as you can. And so it is a little bit different in an existing enterprise because there's a big change management and social engineering component to everything that you do. You've got existing systems that you've got to keep running day in and day out, and you've got some portion of the team that is all about the new way, and you got some portion of the team that has to support the existing ops. And you've got to move everybody along and figure out a strategy to change the wheels on the bus as you're driving down the highway.
And people want data. Like, you don't want to have a complicated way of presenting it to them. You want to just be able to give them what they're asking for.
Yeah, that's right. And then this whole data streaming strategy with better stewardship over the data and so forth, you know, there's a compelling case to be made, because if you look at the way we do it today, you have to have a meeting with 10 engineers to explain to you where the data is. You know, they're talking about, they're naming tables, and it just makes your eyes bleed.
We're going to do a 19-way inner join.
Right, right, exactly, from four different sources, and it's just uber complicated. And what you want is the business leader to just walk up to this data steward and say, here's what I'm trying to do. Can you help me? And the person on the other side of that conversation is able to say, yes, I do this all the time, and I will make the details go away, and I will configure this API to get you the data, or I know how to push this data to this place it always gets pushed. And that's not really technology. That's just an organizational change that can make a big difference. And that's a key element to what we're doing. Now, do we have real technical aspirations to really automate the heck out of all of this data streaming? Absolutely. But, you know, there are social components as well.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like when you were the young guy at the first job.
Right. The translator. That's what it is. That's right. It's the middleman.
Or the guy that knows where that data lives.
Yeah.
He'll go find it for you.
Yeah, exactly. And who better to be the marketer of the data than the system owner that's responsible for it? He knows, or she knows, right? They know their system and they understand what data is there. But no one gives a rat's ass about the name of the tables. No one cares. I've sat in too many meetings in my career where I'm trying to get to the right stuff and I have to wade through all of that. We don't need to do that anymore.
Amen. When you're not making sense of all this enterprise data, what do you do for fun in your spare time?
What do I do for fun? Well, I don't ride my bike enough, although I have a new bike and it is cycling season, so I'm looking to get out. But I spend an awful lot of time worrying about how to save more energy in residential construction.
So in the United States, it's basically like lowest bidder, bottom dollar for most housing that's developed. How are people looking at that to try and improve it?
Right. It's changing slowly in the United States, but that's essentially it. I mean, the entire energy saving strategy in the United States is driven by the building codes. So for years and years and years, the building codes have essentially been about keeping people safe. And I think that's about it. Just enough structural engineering and enough safety engineering that houses don't burn down or collapse. And that doesn't necessarily make for a very energy efficient envelope. And slowly, building departments are catching on. It's become a much bigger imperative with climate change and so forth. But in other parts of the world, you know, particularly Western Europe, there's just a much more conservation-driven mindset that's tied back to engineering. And there's all kinds of really exciting technology that comes out of Europe and great insulation and great wall assemblies and great. I could go on about this for a really long time, but just to give you a sense, years ago on any given Sunday, I could talk to you for hours and hours about insulation technology and closed cell foam versus open cell foam and so forth and the R value of one to the other. We don't even talk about that stuff anymore. Now we've figured out how to insulate buildings pretty efficiently. The challenge is air control and moisture control. The insulation technology has evolved. Keeping the place warm for low cost isn't the problem. Now it's about figuring out how we can drive the energy consumption even lower and lower exchanges with the outside environment. And then once you start sealing off the outside environment, what does that mean to the health of the occupants inside the environment? Because if you start sealing it up like a styrofoam beer cooler, no one can breathe, right?
So you need like a HEPA filter in the house?
You need, right, mechanical ventilation, exactly.
And so that's, I imagine, more expensive than your average HVAC system.
That's right. It's more expensive and more complicated, but ultimately it's a lot more reliable and controlled. You understand in what are all the commercial buildings doing in the pandemic? They're figuring out how many air changes their offices and restaurants have. In commercial construction, they spend some time here, but not enough. And it turns out all the schools that our kids go to don't have enough air changes. So the health of the building becomes the factor. So you can heat the building with a light bulb. That's not an issue anymore, but now you have to figure out how to make the building healthy.
Is there like a metric of number of air changes that's considered healthy?
There's lots of standards, yes. We're looking at those standards now because of viruses.
Mm-hmm.
The number of air changes goes up, but if you're changing air, whether that air on the outside of the building is hotter than the conditioned space or it's colder than the conditioned space, there's more cost associated with that, right? Because you have to condition more outside air. So it'll be interesting. I think the next wave, we figured out insulation technology, and that was super interesting. The industry's figured out air leakage, essentially. And I think it's going back to systems now. So now we realize, oh, we can't completely lock down air quality. We have to keep the air quality healthy. So there's more air changes required, but we need systems to heat and cool the air. So I think there's another wave of those systems, which will be super interesting.
Now, to heat and cool the air, I have to imagine that these energy folks want to do it with solar or something else that's super clean and easy.
Yeah, I think there's a residential building code that's just about to pass in California. No more gas appliances in the state of California.
Really?
So that means no stoves, no dryers, gas or propane, no heating appliances. And the reason is because of the products of combustion from an open flame in the conditioned space is extremely toxic. So that the building code level, they're regulating out, and I think we'll see more and more of that. So yeah, right, the heating sources have to be electric, essentially. Once the heat and all the systems become electric, all the alternatives seem to play well with electric-driven appliances.
I remember in college, when you're going to rent a place, you did not want to rent a place with electric heat because it was going to be a zillion dollars.
Right.
Has that gotten better?
It has, but I mean, your place in college, you could see through the cracks in the windows and the doors, right? So I think the electric heating technology could get a lot better. It's just like my electric car. The motor in my electric car is a lot more efficient than the motors of the golf carts of the 1950s. But, you know, insulation played a big, big part in enabling fairly expensive utilities.
I saw this one little subdivision that I used to drive by in East Bridgewater, and their big sign out front was like, these are all geothermal homes, and we're pumping the stuff down into the earth, and that helps us cool in the summer and heat in the winter. Is that a popular thing, or is everyone pretty much passed on that?
I'm an investor in this company called Hypersciences that makes a supersonic rocket projectile for drilling geothermal wells. So I do believe in well drilling technology, but there's a lot of moving parts. That's my one hedge on the whole thing. There's a lot of moving parts. So you got all those pumps and fluids, and it's essentially a heat exchanger on the end of that. The heat exchanger technology has improved tremendously, and I think we'll continue to see great efficiency gains there. But compared to that resistive electric baseboard heater that was in your college apartment, it's a lot more complicated. So that's the challenge, I think, with geothermal. Super interesting.
Yeah, I like simple.
Exactly. Exactly.
So when they're building these super efficient residential structures now, is it more of a modular approach, or is it still stick built, like they say here in the US?
Yeah, I think that's one of the opportunities. And you see a lot of that worldwide, but there's just a better product that can be developed in a factory than you can on site stick built. That's right. One of the things that I follow is there's this national competition around, I think it's called the smart wall, the smartest, most efficient wall assembly. But most of those assemblies are really designed to be built in a factory at scale, which is a part of one of the challenges for the building industry, particularly in the United States, where it's all about building it as cheap as possible. I mean, you think about it, when you walk into a Home Depot to the 2x4 department, a 2x4 costs you $1.26 or something like that. I mean, it's quite remarkable that this highly produced product, which is extremely durable and extremely reliable, and the whole building industry is organized around everything. You know, we call it a 2x4. The 2x4 is 1.5 by 3.5 inches, but you don't have to ever talk about that because everybody knows what you're talking about. You know, windows are sized around that, or 2x6 and whatever. And it's, and so you're competing with this huge, huge, giant industry that's got so much momentum, and it may not be perfect, but one thing it is very inexpensive.
I was looking at some real estate stuff in like 04, 05, 06, and you know, everyone's like, oh, modular's prefab or like a trailer home, and people were looking down on it. But then they started making these really nice structures out of it. And some people were saying exactly what you said. You can build so much more quality in a quality process controlled factory you're making all these things rather than just stick building on site and trying to throw the frame together before it starts raining.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the designs have gotten really good. There's boutique modular home builders, or prefab home builders really is what it is. It's a factory versus field built construction technique. And there's just really interesting companies all over the world, but in the United States as well. And then you have things like the tiny home movement. That's another very factory-friendly construction opportunity. So I think just the amount of computer-aided design, you know, that's become so accessible to such a large portion of the population now. The innovation just builds on itself, right? It's Moore's Law.
So if people want to find out more about this, where can they go online?
Well, so in Europe, the international standard that was developed around high-efficiency homes is called Passive House. And so there's an outpost in the U.S., but the Passive House Foundation is really where to go. In the U.S., there's a lot of material. If you Google net zero homes, N-E-T-Z-E-R-O, there's a lot of information, great information.
All right. And since the Passive House is German, it's P-A-S-S-I-V-H-A-U-S?
You got it. Yep.
Very good.
Yep.
Well, we will also put some links in the show notes where you can learn more about topics we discussed in this episode. And we will have a link to all our other episodes, which are available at underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio, where you can find this episode and all our previous episodes to listen to on your favorite podcast client or right there on the website. So Matt, thank you so much for coming down today and telling us your story and sharing some of your interests with our listeners.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm really happy to be here. This is just a new aspect to my relationship with Syrinx Consulting. So this is an always evolving relationship. So I really appreciate it.
Well, we're very glad you could make it down today. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.